supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Though the worst of the so-called bomb cyclone has moved through our region on its way to New England, its effects will continue well into the weekend. Meteorologists say wind chill values could fall as low as 15 degrees below zero. Despite the high winds and several inches of snow, few power outages have been reported by PECO and PSE&G. Many school districts will be closed tomorrow, as will all Philadelphia government offices, and SEPTA will operate on an enhanced Saturday schedule. Meanwhile, for tonight, clearing skies, but wind gusts to 34 miles an hour, falling back to 10 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny, still windy, high 15. Saturday, sunny, blustery up to 13 degrees. And for Sunday, sunny, high approaching 20. The Trump administration's recent decision to effectively hold off on building a new Amtrak tunnel under the Hudson River is raising concerns about the future of infrastructure projects closer to Philadelphia. Late last week, the Federal Transit Administration revoked a pledge made by the Obama administration to cover half of the construction costs. Now, Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports that some experts are concerned that SEPTA's projects could also be in trouble.
The 106-year-old rail tunnel connecting New Jersey with New York City's Penn Station is in bad shape. And to fix it, you'd have to severely cut back on train traffic on Amtrak's busiest line for years. That's why the plan was to build a new tunnel next to it first and keep the trains running smoothly along the Northeast Corridor. The Obama administration agreed to pay for half of the project's multi-billion-dollar price tag and loan New York and New Jersey the rest. At least that was the plan, until last week when a Trump appointee sent a letter to state officials reneging on that promise and describing the tunnel as, quote, a local project. So if Trump's unwilling to fund that project, what's it mean for the truly local ones, like SEPTA's proposal to extend the Norristown high-speed line to King of Prussia? The signal is clear, says Richard Geddes, director of the Cornell Infrastructure Policy Program.
So I think that this letter suggests more scrutiny, certainly a higher level of scrutiny about that standard than maybe the previous administration had.
SEPTA's penciled in the federal government to cover about half of the billion-dollar project's estimated cost. But despite making big promises to pass a massive infrastructure spending bill, Trump has instead tried to cut federal transportation funding, says Josh Seven of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia.
But it is very clear that this shift to local funding is continuing intentionally, and there's been a big shift towards that.
In his first budget proposal, Trump actually proposed gutting the grant program SEPTA is relying on for the King of Prussia extension. SEPTA, for its part, isn't worried. It'll be another 2 years before they're ready to apply for federal money. So they've got time to come up with a new funding plan if they have to, says Liz Smith, SEPTA's Director of Strategic Planning.
The fact that for KOP we're just getting ready to begin the 20-year financial plan is actually a good thing, because we can address those concerns and those issues within that analysis and within that plan itself.
Still, whatever money the federal government doesn't kick in will have to be made up locally. That might mean diverting funds from other projects. That might mean new taxes. Or that might mean the extension just doesn't get built. But if SEPTA runs into any snags finalizing their construction plans, they might not be ready to build until 2021. By then, we might have a new president. Sometimes, SEPTA delays aren't all that bad. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
The radio show Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX recently reported on the origins of the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, in which Hillary Clinton and other high-level officials within the Democratic Party were running a child sex trafficking ring out of a Washington, D.C. pizzeria called Comet Ping Pong. The theory is completely false, but it led a North Carolina man to bring a semi-automatic rifle and other weapons to Comet Ping Pong in December 2016 and fire inside the restaurant. No one was hurt. Reveal's reporting, a collaboration with Rolling Stone magazine and the investigative fund, dug into how the theory began and how it spread online. Laura Starcheski is a senior reporter and producer at Reveal. She joins me to shed light on a local conspiracy theorist and Trump supporter named Jack Posobiec, who pushed Pizzagate online. Laura, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Jack Posobiec.
Jack is a very intriguing guy. I actually started tracking Jack on Twitter before the election and before Pizzagate took off. At that time, he had a title, Special Projects Director for this grassroots political organization called Citizens for Trump. And I got really interested in him because he's from Norristown, Pennsylvania, and I'm from Collegeville, which is just a couple towns over. So a little bit of background on Jack. He's in his early 30s. He's a lieutenant in the Naval Reserves. He went to Temple here in Philly, and he's worked on a couple Republican election campaigns here in Pennsylvania. I actually met up with Jack on Election Day in 2016, and I asked him how he defines himself.
I would say I see myself as something kind of different, something new, sort of in between activist and journalist. I'm certainly recording and journaling what's going on, but at the same time I certainly would not say that I'm unbiased. I do take a side, and I'm very open about that.
How did Jack help to spread Pizzagate?
In our reporting, we found out that elements of this theory actually surfaced, before the election on Twitter, on Facebook, on anonymous message boards like Reddit and 4chan. And the theory, interestingly, really took off after the election was over, in part thanks to Jack. So Jack, knew about this theory, decided to go investigate it for himself. He live streamed a video of himself going into Comet Ping Pong. This was on November 16th, so about a week after the election. And nothing happened inside the restaurant when Jack went in. He sat down, he ordered some garlic knots, and when the staff realized what he was doing, they kicked him out. But once he came outside, he seemed completely convinced that this conspiracy theory was real.
The threat level here is much higher than I thought it would be. The stuff that was going on is much, much worse than I thought it would be. And this, we're dealing with some high level stuff here, guys. We're doing some very high level stuff. There are people here that have a lot of interests and a lot of money. So they have a big secret that they are trying to hide.
Give us a sense of the folks who bought into this idea that there was a big secret to hide.
A lot of people bought into this. That video that Jack made that night actually has gotten over 375,000 views on YouTube. He has almost 250,000 Twitter followers now. And last May, Jack got a White House press pass. So his star kept rising. He was working for a conservative Canadian media outfit called The Rebel. And then this past August, just a few days after the white supremacist violence that happened in Charlottesville, Jack really hit the big time because he tweeted about gun violence in Chicago. And that tweet got retweeted by President Trump.
Why does he have such a huge following?
It's interesting. When I met Jack in person, he was really polite and upbeat. But online, he's totally ruthless, and he will basically say anything to stir up a controversy. In 2016, after the election, he claimed a Trump supporter was physically assaulted at the trolley car diner here in Mount Airy. And his followers attacked the diner with thousands of phone calls and Facebook messages after that. Some of them were threatening. And now he really tends to go national. So, for instance, in June, he interrupted a Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar in New York City. He claimed that it encouraged violence against the political right. He orchestrated a boycott of the 2016 Rogue One Star Wars movie, which he said was anti-Trump. And the list really just goes on and on.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Starczewski is a reporter at Reveal. You can hear Reveal on WHYY Sundays at 4 in the afternoon. Their Pizzagate reporting aired in November in an episode called Pizzagate, a slice of fake news. You can find that in Reveal's podcast feed. Weeknights at 8 on WHYY, we take a look at the day's global news on the world. Currently, the show is traveling the United States to see how globalization is impacting communities and states in a series called 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World. Today, they're looking at the most edible state, according to Savour magazine, owing to its rich and diverse food culture. The state is also billing itself as the international food import-export capital of the nation, and that's what took the world's Jason Margolis to New Jersey.
At the warehouse of food exporter Y International USA, the shelves are lined with brand name American products.
Gatorade, Skippy Peanut Butter, Splenda Sugar Substitutes, Quaker Oatmeal.
Scott Weber shows me around this new warehouse in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. For the past year, workers have been repackaging boxes and putting Arabic labeling on American foods bound for the Middle East.
In Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman.
Why set up shop in New Jersey? Simple.
Location. We have the biggest ports in the world. We have five airports that are flying directly to our seven regions that we currently go to. We have direct flights, and we have time-sensitive material, which is food.
Dairy products need to get overseas in a hurry. Y International is just the latest in a long and growing list of foreign food companies in the state, says Michelle Brown. She's president of Choose New Jersey, an industry-funded nonprofit that tries to attract business.
We have nearly 2,000 food businesses in our state. We have more than 190 world headquarters of food companies in our state.
Still, New Jersey? The food capital of America? Really?
Really, New Jersey.
Brown rattles off the way her state is the ideal place to import-export food.
We have great rail. Great rail that crisscrosses the state, that goes... Warehousing in the state of New Jersey is probably the hottest industry right now. You can reach 22 million consumers in 2 hours.
And if you're a foreign food company looking to launch in the U.S., the state has the only so-called soft landing food incubator in the nation. That means they'll hold your hand to get your product launched. At Rutgers University's Food Innovation Center, bottles of a new tea are being tested. I met there with Executive Director Lou Cooperhouse.
So they're going to make the tea in the kettle, and they pump it overhead. And then it comes down here and gets filled.
Cooperhouse says many of his international customers think the biggest challenge selling in the U.S. will be regulatory. It's not.
Their biggest challenge is actually marketing. It's such a competitive landscape in America. It is so different than the European market. So it's really important that they really differentiate themselves. Just because a product sells well in Europe, it's easily to get lost in America.
Now here's the part of the story where the reporter would introduce a Spanish, Italian, or Belgian company that's using these services. And I was supposed to meet up with a Greek gyros company in southern New Jersey, but things didn't exactly work out. So I had to speak with Takis Solomos in Athens via speakerphone.
I apologize for not being able to coordinate with my colleagues in the
phone connection wasn't the best. Solomos is an investor with Megas Gyros. They make kebab meats. He says they work with Rutgers to get advice on food safety regulations, marketing, and figuring out what will sell in the U.S.
We know that we can pick up a phone and make a call to a friend, get some assistance. You know, the guys there are great.
Even when they're giving candid but harsh advice. Solomos says they were ready to roll out a style of Greek sausage for American consumers. Then Lou Cooperhouse and his team weighed in.
I actually liked it, but I knew it was different. We were unusually split. Like half the group literally hated it. This was like a combination of flavors that was out there. You know, it was just, but anyway, well, that being said, so I got back with an honest answer and said, no.
Better to hear that before you go to market. The folks in New Jersey do want Greek sausages to be a winner. Back in the lab, Cooperhouse says successful foreign products mean more jobs in New Jersey.
The county that we're in, Cumberland County, is actually the poorest county in terms of per capita income in the entire state. We're also in one of the poorest cities of over 500 cities in New Jersey. But we're really taking a very aggressive route at the globalization of the food economy.
At the end of the day, Cooperhouse and others in the state think they've got enough to offer. So when foreign food companies think of coming to the U.S., they'll think first of the Garden State.
So we're really taking the mentality of Hollywood, as it is to entertainment, and applying that same logic to having New Jersey being the cluster for the food sector.
And the award for Best Imported Greek Kebab goes to? Yeah. Jason Margolis, Bridgeton, New Jersey.
That story comes to us from PRI's The World, heard weeknights at 8 on WHYY-FM. Tomorrow marks the start of the second annual Philly Loves Bowie Week. Now, this time it offers more than a week of events related to David Bowie on the second anniversary of his death. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the festival will feature a new book and a film premiere.
My Bowie Story is a book of writings by fans who describe the impact David Bowie had on them personally. It was self-published by Dale Perry of Ewing, New Jersey. She compiled submissions from more than 60 people across 8 countries. Perry recently retired as an office manager for New Jersey's Division of Criminal Justice, and she says most people don't peg her as a Bowie fan.
You look too conservative. Like, you don't look like you're some wild rock star kind of girl. Of course, I'm a lot older now, too. But some people who are not Bowie fans may have gotten stuck into the image of Bowie in the 70s, say, in the outrageous outfits or whatever. They're not seeing the Bowie that's so inspirational or so kind.
Perry will be at a happy hour event next week at World Cafe in West Philadelphia, where 100% of all book sales will be donated to the Children's Hospital Philadelphia. Afterwards, a rough cut of a new documentary film will be screened. It's called The Sigma Kids. It chronicles David Bowie's time at Sigma Studio on 12th Street in Philadelphia, where he recorded songs for his 1975 album, Young Americans. His fans camped outside the studio for days, eager to catch a glimpse of their hero coming and going. Eventually, Bowie asked them all to come inside to be the first to listen to his new songs while nervously seeking their approval. The filmmaker is Anthony Krupe, who admits he was never a particularly big fan of Bowie's music, but he was drawn to that moment at Sigma Studio.
Knowing what we know now about David Bowie, thinking of him as a young musician kind of in the corner watching, not being sure if they're going to like it or not, these are the kind of little stories that kept bringing me back to it.
Krupe has been working on this Bowie documentary for 3 years, since before Bowie died in 2016. He felt that Bowie's relationship to Philadelphia and the Sigma Kids says a lot about the city's place in the history of rock and roll. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Well, as the old song goes, breaking up is hard to do. So Kevin Stroman, a storyteller for WHYY's Common Space, decided to adapt a favorite game of Nerds Everywhere to help himself and others through that often difficult and painful process.
So a few years back, my friend Nick was approached with an idea. What if there was Dungeons and Dragons for breaking up with someone? So if you've never played Dungeons & Dragons before, you are assigned a theoretical, hypothetical character with a set of statistics, and then you are dropped into a scenario, and you play the game by announcing what you are trying to do and then rolling dice to see how well you do it. But as opposed to slaying dragons or rescuing princesses, the goal of the game would be to amicably end a relationship. The game was called We Need to Talk, but like most games, it needed playtesting, lots and lots of playtesting. So in front of a group of 30 or 40 of our friends, I agreed to play. The scenario that Nick and I agreed upon was that he and I were two young gay lovers in a small town in the Midwest. I worked part-time at my father's junkyard, and he was a line cook, but I wanted to move to the big city and get discovered. And if I was going to do that, then I needed to let go of a relationship that was making me happy enough, but wasn't going to survive the changes that were about to happen in my life. So we sit down and we play and we're rolling dice and I'm doing pretty well, all things considered. I'm getting the 3 little like heart points and you need 6 to win and it's going great. And something I didn't expect to happen starts to happen. Not terribly long ago, I had just gotten out of a relationship with a woman that I cared about very deeply, and I had found myself on the other side of a conversation much like this one, only she didn't do a very good job. And I guess I didn't realize it, but I found out myself being pretty raw about the whole thing. And I had reached out later, just not trying to mend the relationship, but just like, hey, I need a postmortem. I have some questions that need answering, and got nowhere. So I'm playing this game, And Nick doesn't know it, but Nick is no longer his character, and I'm no longer my character. I find myself in the peculiar scenario of having to break up with myself and say the things that I desperately needed to hear in order for me to move on. And Nick looks at me, and he says, "Am I just not good enough for you? Is that what this is?" And I say, "I'm not a robot. I don't have personality parameters that need to be met in order to maximize my happiness quotient. It's more complicated than that. It's really complicated. And even if it weren't more complicated than that, and even if you weren't good enough, that doesn't mean you're not a good person." And he says, "You're just going to take everything that we have, and you're just going to throw it all away." And I say, "These things are allowed to just end. Sometimes they're allowed to just end, and just because they end, it doesn't mean they didn't have weight, and it doesn't mean that they didn't matter, and it doesn't mean that I have regrets. And it's okay if you're sad, and it's okay if you're frustrated, and it's okay if you're disappointed and hurt, but it's also just allowed to be okay. Sometimes everything is just allowed to be okay." I win the game, successfully break Nick's heart, and presumably pave the way for my character to move to New York, chase my big-time Broadway dreams or whatever. There's a round of applause, obviously. Nick says it's the heaviest the game's ever gotten. It's great. But afterwards, a friend of mine comes up to me, and he says, "Wow, that was really good. How did you get to be so good at breaking up with people?" And I shrug and force a smile, and I say, "I've had a lot of practice. Thank you."
Kevin Stroman's story comes to us from Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It can be heard on the last Sunday of each month on WHYY-FM and via podcast. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.